intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. I wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Leatherback Guardians by Nina Berling. In Panama, conservationists are tracking endangered turtles and fighting for their legal rights. The members of the Leatherback Project are nursing warm cokes and thin coffee at a military base on the edge of Panama City. Nearby, four Panamanian Air Force mechanics are silhouettes against a sunlit green backdrop of jungle as they huddle around a tiny camouflage-painted Cessna. It is unclear when the little plane last flew, but it is definitely not ready for takeoff. The team's departure hour on that plane has been a moving target all morning, and now it's creeping into afternoon. They might not get down to the indigenous village of Armila, near the Panama-Colombia border, before dark. Nighttime is when female leatherback turtles crawl out of a Caribbean current that is often too strong for human swimmers and lay the eggs of their next generation of their dwindling species. The founder of the Leatherback Project, Callie Vielenturf, doesn't mind the delay. A marine biologist with wide-set hazel eyes and long reddish hair and a tight braid, she always looks vulnerable and much younger than her age of 31. And today, she is a whiter shade of pale. "I just threw up," she says, rather merrily as she arrives. "I'm always airsick and boatsick now. I feel like that all the time." Vielenturf established the Leatherback Project as a non-governmental organization just before the COVID-19 pandemic. Since then, she has traded robust health for endangered turtles. As a result of the world catching the coronavirus, she came down with Zika or dengue. She doesn't know which. Sick for weeks, she was left with fibromyalgia and other chronic ailments. None of this has halted her work. With a small team, she has been tagging turtles on the Pacific and Caribbean coasts of Panama, studying their habits in water and on land, analyzing nests, logging eggs and hatchlings, and training local indigenous communities to do the nightly turtle data collection. The Leatherback family has been on Earth since the Cretaceous period, 110 million years ago, but much is still unknown about these turtles and their habits. They eat nearly a ton of jellyfish a day, weighing half a ton to 1.5 tons, making them the heaviest non-crocodilian reptiles, and live their whole lives in the open sea. Only females return to land to lay eggs roughly once every 3 to 5 years. Once common all over the world's oceans, leatherbacks now exist in only 7 populations worldwide. According to the Leatherback Project, 4 of these populations are now considered critically endangered due to low population size or a decline of more than 80% in the last decade. One population is rated as endangered. There is insufficient data on the other 2 groups to assess their status. The Leatherback Project is comparatively small in the universe of sea turtle and ocean conservation. The Leatherback Trust, for example, tracks the migration of 500 sea turtles and has assets of $2.4 million. Vielenturf's project also differs from other conservation efforts in its focus on policy goals. Vielenturf is an internationally known advocate for the rights of nature law, a radical legal construction rooted in the so-called deep ecology movement of the 1970s that gives nature personhood rights. Under the law, a self-appointed guardian, any citizen in theory, may file a case on behalf of a logged rainforest, a polluted river, any living system or creature whose habitat is threatened by human activities. According to VelandTurf, the Leatherback Project is the only leatherback turtle nonprofit focused on risks to the species at sea, where they get tangled in plastic fishing nets and drown as bycatch. The project is working with fishermen and large fisheries to reduce this bycatch. The project is currently studying nesting areas on the Caribbean side of Panama, around Armilla and the Pearl Islands archipelago, a strip of 200 islands and islets on the Pacific side. For about 3 to 5 months every year, the females crawl up on land and lay hundreds of eggs in periods of about 9 days. They barely eat during the laying season. At the end of it, depleted, they paddle thousands of miles north or east to feed on the jellyfish that sustain them. The endangered subpopulation of turtles near Armilla happens to nest just 125 to 150 nautical miles east of the traffic jams of colossal freighters at the entrance of the Panama Canal. Human activity is the chief threat to the turtles. Humans eat them or their eggs. They cover their nesting beaches with trash or develop them into resorts and ports. And people contribute to a changing climate. Higher temperatures around the nest can simply cook the eggs. The heat also hurts breeding prospects by creating a gender imbalance. With temperatures are below 82 degrees Fahrenheit, more males hatch, while temperatures above about 88 degrees lead to more females hatching. In fact, turtle scientists shorthand to hot chicks, cool dudes. Besides collecting data in the nesting areas, VelandTurf has attached satellite transponders to 17 sea turtles on the beaches of the Pacific and 11 near the neighboring towns of Armilla, Panama, and Acandí, Colombia. They are the first leatherbacks in Colombia and along the east coast of Panama to be tagged with transponders. These turtles, representative of an estimated population in the thousands, appear in real time on her laptop screen as different colored lines, zigzagging up and down a map of the Colombian and Panamanian coasts. The transponders are expensive, between $1,500 and $5,000 each, a significant amount of money for a small operation like hers. But VelandTurf says that mapping has very tangible conservation management implications for the tiny Gulf of Uraba. New ports are being planned there, one of which has already started construction. It is abundantly clear from VelandTurf's data that ship traffic in and out of the small notch of the Gulf will disrupt active leatherback turtle nesting waters. Through the transponders, she hopes to provide evidence that might influence decisions about the new shipping lanes. On this May trip, probably the last one to the Panama-Colombia border coast during the winter-spring laying season, VelandTurf's voluminous waterproof backpack holds four more transponders she hopes to attach to turtles nesting on the little gulf on the Colombian side. At the moment, she has no permit from the local government to visit the beach or tag the turtles there. As thunderclouds bunch to the south, a pair of youthful Panamanian pilots appear. One is wearing braces, making him look even younger. Soon the old Cessna is bouncing through the cumulus, the dense rainforest below resembling a head of broccoli. The Panamanian isthmus is so narrow and so sinuous that from above it is hard to tell which body of water is the Pacific and which is the Caribbean. An hour later, the Cessna touches down on a strip of asphalt in the jungle village of Puerto Obaldia. The team's arrival interrupts the little soccer game by the runway. Men in day-glow green shirts and shorts stop and watch. Children and mothers holding babies rise from hammocks to see the team disembark. Roadless jungle extends beyond the village, and the only way in or out is from the ocean, by plane or boat. The area is known as the Darien Gap, the point where the Pan-American Highway ends, and for 60 miles, nature reigns supreme. As untamed as this land is, it is a path that human feet have trod for millennia. The ancestors of South American indigenous people arrived via this route from the far north many thousands of years ago. Now, hundreds of thousands of northbound migrants, often with children in tow, trek through the gap in the other direction, choosing to risk days of snakes and mud to reach jobs and safety hence the soldiers. The government discouraged the leatherback project team from traveling in the area without official accompaniment. The area is both a frequently traveled migrant route north and a drug smuggling territory. At Puerto Obaldía, Panama's border guards at the frontier with Colombia check IDs, automatic weapons strapped on. They lead the team through the village and onto a wooden boat that sets a course into swells and toward the sunset. Armila sits at the mouth of the Armila River and is buffeted by heavy Caribbean waves. Access by water, the only way to the town, is tricky. To complete the final 200 yards of the journey, travelers perform an acrobatic maritime exercise of transferring themselves and their luggage into a small wooden boat that can navigate the coastal surf. As we arrive at dusk, through a haze of spindrift and light rain, the village looks like a set from Gilligan's Island. A row of thatched roofs, coconut trees, beach boats, children playing in the shallows. The piercing sound of a bird, a parrot perhaps, cuts through the roar of surf as Velen Turf and her team drag gear around hand-carved dugouts and small painted boats with high prows. A non-working telephone booth stands sentinel on shore. Short-haired women in traditional mola, colorful blouses, which they wear along with orange beads on their calves and forearms, stand like warriors, watching their men pull the boat onto the sand. Children splash in brown waters under the late-day pink light. The Guna people of Armila are one of Panama's seven indigenous tribes, and the larger region, Gunayala, consists of hundreds of small islands. The Guna are deeply connected to water, fearless in open boats on towering swells. They believe the leatherback contains in its body all of Earth's history because of its ancient lineage. A Guna marine biologist on the expedition, Ramacelia Ramirez, a technician at Panama's Aquatic Resources Authority, says colonizers first taught the indigenous Guna people to eat them. "For us, the turtle used to be sacred," she says. "It was like a spirit with whom we shared a sense of fraternity." One of the aims of the Leatherback Project is to help support local people. Velen Turf is training University of Panama biology students Nenelis Liz Rios and Wigildali Wiggy Crespo, as well as Armila High School students, conduct their own field research during the nesting season. The community's role may become more formal as it works with the project to explore the idea of an official reserve around its shores. Velen Turf is unusual among scientists in her passion for policy. During the pandemic, she connected with Panama's first lady, Yasmin Colon de Cortizo, and Juan Diego Vasquez Gutierrez, then 25, who was the youngest member of Panama's National Assembly. In February 2022, Panama passed a countrywide rights of nature law, only the third nation to do so, after Bolivia and Ecuador. In November 2023, environmental and indigenous groups successfully used the law to shut down a copper mine located in a biodiverse area on the Caribbean Sea. Velen Turf also helped push for a specific rights of turtles law, which allows people to bring suits against industry and developers on behalf of turtles. The legislature passed the turtle protections in March 2023. Velen Turf has also advocated for Panama to enact rights of nature laws to formally protect sharks. And she's working with scientists in the Peruvian jungle to protect bees and in Indonesia to protect gibbons. Velen Turf's soft-spoken, almost passive disposition camouflages raw energy. During the month I tracked her, she was on the go, in demand, extremely hard to catch up with. Besides doing nocturnal field work on both coasts of Panama, she was in Washington, D.C. for a week-long National Geographic conference, speaking in New York City at the Explorers Club and at the United Nations, and appearing before the state legislature in Rhode Island, where she went to college, and on Panamanian television, discussing the turtle nesting season. She was also writing a book proposal. "I can't get anything done unless I have too many things going on," she says. Light rain, moonless night. At a long picnic table in the open-air thatched hut where the team eats meals and taps the only Wi-Fi for miles around, Thielen Turf discusses the night's plan with her colleagues. Ramirez, the Panamanian technician, Marino Abrego, chief of Oceans and Marine Division of Panama's Ministry of Environment, and Nikki Ritty, the head of multimedia for the Leatherback Project. Her pallor from earlier in the day has disappeared. The sea air or the simple proximity of her passion, the turtles, has revitalized her. Thielen Turf knew from childhood growing up in the village of Norfolk, Massachusetts, that she wanted to save animals, but she didn't know exactly how or what kind. She was smart, an only child, a sax-playing band camp nerd, with an unusual neurological trait called synesthesia. She sees musical notes and letters of the alphabet in specific colors. On a high school graduation trip to Hawaii, she encountered her first marine turtle while snorkeling, and she had an epiphany. It was like when you look at your dog's eyes and see their soul. I looked into its eyes, and I could see how wise it was, and after that, I knew what I wanted to do. After she earned a degree in marine biology from the University of Rhode Island, she began working with leatherback turtles on the shores of Equatorial Guinea on a project for her master's degree in biology. She is now a PhD student in turtle conservation at the University of Central Florida. Thielen Turf and her team clamber in shallow water onto an open boat to cross the river to the nesting beach. The two college biology students and a pair of local high school seniors, one in a LeBron James jersey, hop in, along with a yellow village dog who will trot alongside the motley crew all night. Finally, four camo-clad members of the Panama Border Patrol climb aboard, two carrying machine guns. Setting off in a boat with them felt like tooling up the Mekong Delta in a scene from a Vietnam War movie. The armed guards add to that atmosphere, always present during Thielen Turf's nighttime beach patrols. Until a few months ago, she didn't even walk through Armilla back to her bunk without an armed guard. Thielen Turf works closely with Genoveva Forero, a Panamanian captain in the National Aeronautical Service, who started off providing security and has since joined the project and assists with research. The first time I saw a leatherback turtle, I cried because their energy is unbelievable, says Ferrero. I could feel the energy on the animal. Listening to the sounds they make feels like being in Jurassic Park. It really is indescribable. On the edge of the roaring ocean, we disembark. Several people don headlamps, turn to red light mode. White light will disturb the turtles and drive them back into the water. We start to hike. The surf slams, invisible a few feet away in the profound blackness, the undertow sucking back, the stormy breeze dizzying. And then, suddenly, there she is, illuminated in red light, a creature the size of a smart car, with a flexible chevron-shaped carapace and dinosaur-like head. Thielen Turf moves closer, and the team settles down around her. This turtle, Thielen Turf explains, has already excavated a hole some 3 feet deep in the sand with her powerful flippers, laid her eggs, and is now hiding the nest by kicking sand over it and around it. The animal appears not to notice us. Egg-laying turtles are said to be in a trance while concentrating on the task at hand. In the dark, she resembles a giant insect or alien, except for the huge head, strangely emotional. Salty tears seeping from her eyes, a natural mechanism that helps flush out sand, according to Thielen Turf. The researchers take up positions on the ground in a circle around her. The two high school boys come around with a measuring tape. The kid in the LeBron jersey gently brushes the sand off the turtle's back and measures it with the tape. The two college students pull out a clipboard and jot down vitals: size, location, the nest distance from the surf, and from the tree line beyond the sand. Someone pulls out a special metal detector to quickly scan the animal for any previously attached metal tag. Part of Thielen Turf's project involves not just attaching passive integrated transponders, but also affixing tiny metal number tags like ID badges to the turtles to keep count of populations and for future researchers. If they don't find a tag, they attach one. After recording the vitals, the students insert a temperature gauge into the nest, which will remain there until the eggs hatch. The little expedition moves onward. Not more than a few hundred yards on, the red light picks out another behemoth. This one is still in the process of laying eggs. We can hear her rhythmic slow breathing over the sound of the waves. Ramirez and Veilenturf get on their stomachs in the sand behind the turtle, with gaiters pulled up over their noses to deflect the tiny insects attracted to the nest. Gently lift the tail and count the eggs. They record 67 orbs glowing in the light of their headlamps. Veilenturf and her team moved on down the beach. In 95 days, a team member will return to see how many eggs hatched, how many hatchlings crawled out, and how many died in embryo or without getting out of the nest. For those who make it into the sea, nature is not kind. It is estimated that just 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 10,000 sea turtles reach adulthood. The animal's fertility and life cycle are still somewhat of a mystery to scientists. Leatherbacks live for at least 50 years, but perhaps much longer. They may not start reproducing until they are 20. Their mating process has rarely been observed and never been described in scientific detail. Females lay eggs fertilized by different males, and Veilenturf says they seem to be able to store and even decide which sperm to use. Veilenturf and the crew deem the first night on the beach a success. By the time the sky begins to lighten, around 4 a.m., they have logged 7 turtles. But as the sun rises, the appalling state of the beach becomes visible. Besides sargassum, seaweed clogging shores all over the hemisphere this year, probably due to ocean warming and nitrogen runoff, there are drifts of trash. We see that we've been walking through a field of shoes, disposable diapers, plastic bottles, and broken bits of boat and other machines. There are so many shoes in the sand that one visiting journalist told me she broke a sandal in the dark and easily found not one, but many sandals that fit. The Armilla Beach Trust is a stark reminder that Panama's well-intentioned rights of nature law can only do so much. Its effectiveness is limited by human activity nearby and farther away. The surrounding Darien region is Panama's poorest, and the sanitation services in the jungle are non-existent. Trash streams onto the beach from villages upriver and washes up from marine dumping around the Caribbean. Even Armilla, where villagers serve as unofficial turtle guardians, lack any form of green trash disposal and burns its waste. Further away, fossil fuels heat up great cities and move billions of people by car and plane, spewing carbon, heating land and water. In Colombia, the situation is even more dire. Turtles, of course, know no borders, and corporations, bent on jungle resource extraction, including of gold and oil, have benefited from a port-building spree on the other side of the Gulf of Uraba. Colombia boasts 60 ports, a record number for a country of its size. The country has approved the construction of 3 ports on the eastern side of the Gulf. According to Carla Barrientos Munoz, a Colombian environmental activist, the turtles were not taken into account in the environmental impact studies. Colombia's environmental licensing agency told Smithsonian that of the 3 new ports licensed in the area, only one is currently under construction, and all 3 are subject to environmental evaluation. Asked about the turtles specifically, a spokesperson emailed that the agency is aware of the project's living, non-living, and socioeconomic implications. The ports are to be located near the towns of Necoclí and Turbo on the Gulf of Uraba. The 2 towns are on the migrant route leading north toward the United States, which has changed the economy. Veilenturf has tagged turtles near Acandí, another town on the migrant route. On this trip, she had hoped to tag a few more turtles at Necoclí to collect data to add to potential environmental impact studies. But she and local activists are in the dark about what will happen next with the port plans. It's very frustrating for us because no matter how many doors we knock, we can't find answers to why they would build 3 ports in the same locations as Munoz, who has been helping Veilenturf. It is also clear to us that they want to do it because they think they represent development, which is a great political strategy to win votes. She adds that along with the promise of jobs, Ports often bring prostitution and drugs to small villages, unprepared for the explosion of economic activity. Environmentalists in Colombia have successfully challenged port builders elsewhere in the country, including a massive port that had been planned for a biologically diverse area known as Tribuga on the Pacific coast. Colombian marine biologist Diana Ruiz-Pino conducted studies that helped persuade the government to abandon those plans. But for her involvement in the opposition, Ruiz-Pino faced death threats and was forced to relocate to Europe. The danger to environmentalists in Colombia is real. As of 2022, the nation topped the list of countries that had most murders of environmental activists. Ruiz-Pino says companies will use the ports to extract resources in remote but roadless regions rich in minerals or timber. They need a big infrastructure to build a road to take the petrol and the gold and all the rare earths out, she says. In recent years, the Colombian government has been in the habit of granting the permissions, Ruiz-Pino says. She hopes the new government, elected in 2022, is more amenable to environmental concerns. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time where we'll finish this article about the Leatherback Project. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.